are listening to True Crime Fiction, feeding your addiction to the best of the written and the spoken word in crime. If you would like to support the podcast, you can do so for as little as £1 at patreon.com/truecrimefiction.
Hello, Mari.
Hello, Phil. How are you?
Very, very well, thank you. Welcome to Hercule Dercule.
Thank you. We've had a very long Hercule Dercule. It's past 2 on a Sunday afternoon and we have not yet got out of bed.
I feel like Grandpa Joe.
I actually feel like this is the upside of adult life when you get to do this, you know.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair payback.
Yeah, me too. Like, that's the upside of like work and looking after kids is you occasionally get days where you can spend all day in bed and it's bliss.
I think so.
So we have a new case that we're Hercule-ing and Dercule-ing today. Just to remind old listeners and let any new listeners know, Hercule Dercule is a Scots word which means to lie in a warm bed long after it is the time to get up.
Which in Scotland is very, very early, I would imagine. The time you're supposed to get up.
But why in Scotland?
I don't know. I just have this kind of, you know, this kind of Protestant kind of work ethic mentality would, you know, the idea of staying late in bed has to have its own word because it's so abhorrent.
But what's a lie-in then?
A lie-in is where you're lying in. I mean, it's not a special word.
It's a word for the same thing. It's just less fun.
Yeah. No, but I do think it's probably frowned upon a little bit more in certain parts of Scotland.
Whereas in Ireland, everyone's just lolling about all morning.
Well, I mean, they're work shy and generally layabouts, yes.
Well, you can say that. I would not. So, the case we have today, I first heard of this case because you mentioned it to me. And it seems like it's a really big one in Ireland, but I'd never heard of it before. So, is it as big as I'm imagining it to be?
Well, I wasn't in Ireland at the time, but I was obviously following Irish media, and I suppose it stands out because of kind of the specific nature of the case. So you have this, the sexual aspect, it was BDSM, kind of master-slave relationship between the victim and the murderer. And then, you know, within Ireland, it's perceived as good old Catholic Ireland with its conservative views on sexuality. And obviously that's not strictly true, but at the same time, it's a small country with a relatively small population. And something like this does stand out. It doesn't happen that often. Also, there was elements of the class and status of the perpetrator, in comparison to the victim. This kind of just in it kind of sociologically is interesting in Ireland. Also, the way the murder was discovered, it was only after a year that any of this came to light, that it began to be investigated as a murder, due to the discovery of evidence and the body, which again is a little unusual. The way that the body and the evidence was found was quite unusual because of just the circumstances, the unusual climatic weather conditions meant that what should have been lost forever was retrievable.
Yeah, this is one of the few times in life where you actually go, thank goodness for global warming.
Well, exactly. I mean, and it was obviously something that wasn't anticipated by the murderer. it was,
Well, I think we can say that all the worst people don't anticipate climate change.
That it will affect their best laid plans.
Mm. So the woman who was murdered was Elaine O'Hara. What can you tell me about her?
Well, she was a 36-year-old childcare worker. She also had a part-time job as and working in a newsagent. And she worked, she had secured work as a steward for the Tall Ships Festival to be taking place in Dublin in 2012. So I suppose the most remarkable thing about her was her mental health, that she was someone who had serious mental health issues, had been hospitalized many times throughout her life, and had undergone treatment for this, and how this also fed into her self-esteem and her kind of image of herself. And I'd say how she ended up making contact with the murderer.
But she also had quite a few physical health issues as well, didn't she? Because I think there was asthma, diabetes, polycystic ovaries, and irritable bowel, which are, you know, chronic conditions. So they're ones you have to live with rather than you can take a pill and you're going to be fine. So she had a lot going on, and that's exhausting for yes. people to cope with. So
yeah, all of the physical ailments are going to contribute greatly to your mental health. So that's going to be very challenging to somebody who's already got issues with depression.
So what sort of mental health support would have been available for Elaine at that point in Ireland? I know that in Britain, our mental health system is not adequate. And while we get a lot of very warm words said about the need for better mental health, there really isn't the sort of the backing money-wise and budget-wise for that to really happen properly.
Yeah, I don't and haven't lived in Ireland for many years, so I don't have first-hand experience of it, but I imagine it suffers similarly in terms of underfunding and under-resourcing and difficulty accessing in terms of waiting list times and limited treatments as well. So it's difficult to make direct comparisons because Ireland doesn't really have the same national health service like you have here in Scotland. It is, most people are obliged to take on private health insurance.
Mm.
This isn't as exploitative as, say, somewhere in the United States where the costs are of getting health insurance are exorbitant. But they historically shied away from a national healthcare service because they saw it as being too socialist, too communist in style. So Ireland has always been very... there's been a strong element of resisting left-wing initiatives. So that would have complicated access to mental health. But she did have access to mental health because obviously she was hospitalised on many occasions. So it's obviously there for those people who are in desperate need of it. And she also had the access to doctors and therapists, one of whom was Dr. Anthony Clare.
He is quite well known, isn't he?
He is, yes, or he was. He's not with us anymore, but he was a very famous psychiatrist who hosted a BBC Radio 4 programme called In the Psychiatrist's Chair, which aired for about 20 years through the 80s and 90s, where he interviewed stars and celebrities and got them to open up about themselves and reveal things that they might otherwise have been keeping to themselves.
Yeah, I can remember listening to some of them when they were on. It was quite a long-running series, I think, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that popped up on the podcast I listened to about this case, which was the Sunday News. Is that the correct title?
The Sunday World.
The Sunday World. Because as soon as I think world, I always think News of the World, which is now a defunct paper. in Britain, which had a really terrible reputation. But the Sunday World had a really good podcast about this case, which I'd recommend to people. And one of the things they touched on, but nobody has actually gone into in any detail, was that Elaine, in her conversations with Dr. Anthony Clare, said that she felt like she was a boy trapped in a woman's body, mm-hmm. and that when they did some blood tests on her, her testosterone count was very high.
Yeah.
Now, I'm assuming by that they mean high for a female body, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, high, what would be high for a male body. And that kind of had me wondering, maybe Elaine was trans, and that could therefore be part of why, you know, she's really struggling in life, both with her mental health and her physical health, if that's not something she's been able to like fully explore or fully be out with, or even confident in exploring. Maybe she didn't have any room to explore that in her life, and the stress of that comes out in other ways. Yeah. So I kind of thought that feels kind of important to me.
But then I was... Yeah, I think it's interesting, an interesting observation, and it would have been, this analysis would have taken before 2008, I think, which is when he died. So we're talking about mid-2000s, and this would have kind of predated any kind of major awareness of issues around trans. And so, you know, looking at it now, from where we are now, and people's awareness of these this issue, that's certainly something that, yeah, could have been an element of her mental health problems.
I mean, when I first heard it, I thought, oh, maybe this is something that's happening for her, and, you know, this isn't explored in any way. It feels like it's really glossed over. But then I kind of thought, but is it really any of our business at the end of the day? You know, maybe she did explore it in private with her therapist, and it wasn't something she wanted to be public about. And we shouldn't necessarily say somebody is trans unless they've actually said, I am trans and I want to be identified in this way. Mm-hmm. So I kind of, after finding this really interesting at first, I kind of thought maybe going down that line of thinking and questioning could actually be a little bit exploitative, because it's part of the sort of bring out your gays sort of trope, where you know, the gay people in any media and drama and fiction always have to die because that's the saddest.
Mm.
And you know, maybe it's just not our business.
Maybe
at the end of the day.
No, I mean, we are merely speculating, but yeah, it's an interesting point about your cliched LGBTQ victim. That's an interesting point.
Mm. So should we go on to the case? There's quite a lot of details in this case. There's a timeline, which is not as you might expect a timeline for the murder case.
Yeah, I think it's just the amount of coincidences. I mean, you had kind of brought up this, or wanted to negate the idea that this was like the perfect murder, which is, I don't think I thought it was the perfect murder, but I think, A, there was a lot of planning went into it, and the way in which the whole attempt to hide the murder fell apart it's kind of spectacular in itself due to the timing. Like, basically, the first evidence that's found is a year after, just over a year after the murder. On the 10th of September, 2013, a number of fishermen discovered a bag, and the reason they discovered this bag was because the reservoir, which was normally at a depth of 4.6 meters, was at a depth of around 40 centimeters. So it had come right down to, you know, just a couple of feet from the bottom. And so obviously things on the bottom of the reservoir were visible, and they picked out this bag and they brought it to the police, or the Gardaí, as we call them. And it was only like 3 days later, on the 13th of September, that the body was found by a dog walker. It's always a dog walker.
It is always a dog. I think it's actually always a dog.
Yeah.
To be fair.
Well, I suppose dogs are interested in...
smells.
Smells and bones and remains of carcasses. Grim though that is, it's useful. Dogs are playing a role, I suppose. I wonder what the statistics are for that. You know, what else is going to go and sniff out remains of bodies that could be just on the other side of a ditch that you wouldn't, that people would walk by for years and not even notice?
In America, they actually have cadaver dogs, which are apparently trained to scent death, basically.
Yeah.
And so if they're having a hard time sometimes finding remains, they'll use these cadaver dogs, but it's a little hazy, like the evidence on how accurate they
are. No, I mean, well, I think a dog will be able to detect remains. Oh, I've seen dogs in Germany that are used for disasters where they're actually sent in to look for survivors in, say, collapsed buildings, etc. And yeah, they're very effective.
They can do that, but I think there's more that sometimes they might not be, they'll be like saying, oh, I've got a scent here, but the scent then peters out or something like that. And I think there's been some cases where people have been like, oh, my dog definitely showed there was a scent, but then nothing was recovered. So there's some kind of thinking that just because a cadaver dog signals that it has a scent to its trainer, that isn't necessarily 100% proof.
Yeah.
It's like a lie detector test isn't 100% proof.
Oh, there's, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
There's margins for error. So I think there's a difference between when you're using it in disaster situations to help rescue and when you might be using the evidence of a cadaver dog to sentence somebody.
Oh, I understand that you're saying that there was the presence of, right, but there's no actual evidence other than, I could imagine that wouldn't stand up in court.
Yeah, I think.
Especially after seeing, I saw this video on social media the other day of a rabbit outsmarting a dog by hopping down a path and then doubling back and hopping back up and then hiding in the side. And then you see this little dog sprint past where the bunny is hiding.
Oh, well done, that rabbit.
Yeah,
I hope that rabbit lives long.
Yeah, I think they will live very long with skills like that.
I know.
Yes. So 3 days after the first piece of evidence is found in a completely different, what did we decide? It was like 30 kilometers away. You have the body being found by a dog walker, Margalie Vergnet, who's a dog walker and trainer. And this is in a place called Killiquí, which is just in the Dublin Mountains. But it's like one of the most popular areas for walking for the whole city of Dublin, which is the capital city of Ireland. So it's a very unremote place to put a body or to murder someone or whatever the circumstances were. It just seems inevitable that people walk there, people walk their dogs there on a huge scale. So it just seems inevitable that this would have been turned up, or this body would have turned up. I suppose she was eventually identified through dental records, so she would have been identified without the evidence, without the other evidence. So I imagine there would have been a murder inquiry investigation on the basis of the body being found alone. However, the evidence found in the reservoir when this policeman, Garda James O'Donoghue, pursued the evidence that was handed in the bag, that was handed in a few days before, went guddling around the water and pulled up handcuffs and other S&M
paraphernalia,
but as well as this keychain with a loyalty card. And of course, loyalty cards are great trackers of individual records. So He was able to discover her name and discover that she was missing. She had been missing for a year. And on the strength of this, then they sent in the underwater unit, the divers, although they're not going to be diving into 40 centimeters of water, but they are, I suppose, going to be able to have masks that can and things for finding things underwater.
And it is like essentially then a crime scene and a forensic site, so it does need to be treated.
Yeah. No, but I'm sure he was, he's a qualified crime investigator as a Garda, right?
I do not know what qualifications Garda have.
Well, he's a policeman. Police can investigate.
Well, it's just there's hierarchies and things.
No. I'm just saying that, you know, divers, you imagine them, you know, having to dive deep into marshy waters.
Yes.
This is just a paddle out and are looking around. But they did, with their great skills sets, discover two mobile phones, which were, they were the key pieces of evidence that were able to locate the murder and also to unveil the nature of the relationship between victim and murderer, which is again part of the, I suppose, the fascination, the interest in this as something unusual than, you know, most other murders.
So I think one thing that is really worth noting here is that if Elaine's remains had been found on their own, it possibly would not have been a murder investigation because she was known in the past to have suicidal ideation. And I think it could have been a thought process that people would have been, well, she was suicidal. She went up to the mountains, a lovely, peaceful, natural place to end it all. And because mental health kind of overshadows, I think, in people's minds, anything else about an individual, I think it could have been quite easy for people to have just stopped there.
Yes, but and I think also if that's an option for law enforcement to be able to put it into that category, it doesn't involve any investigation. Police forces are under-resourced anyway and under pressure to solve other crimes. So yes, if they're offered that opportunity, they will take it.
Yeah. So I think that one of the key things was discovering things like the keychain with the loyalty card, because nobody kills themselves and then goes and throws their loyalty card away.
Yeah, and if they're going to throw their loyalty card away, it's unlikely they'll do it 30 kilometers away and then drive, you know, completely random place and then drive somewhere else. I mean, this is definitely a red flag for foul play.
Yeah, I think so. So I do think if it hadn't have been for that Garda, then we really could have been in a situation where there was maybe very minimal investigation and Elaine might just have been chalked up as, you know, a missing person who then had been found to have taken her own life.
Yeah, and I mean, she had gone, there had been a whole entire year of her being reported missing where very little had been done in terms of, you know, it already had been kind of chalked down as probable suicide because of her mental health history.
Yeah, and it really speaks to me of the fact that so often when people do have mental health problems, there seems to be assumptions or a set of assumptions at work in general, not specifically on anybody, but in general, that it's like, oh, well, that's the reason for everything that happens to them. You know, like that's the main thing in their life. And while mental health problems can at times very often be the main thing in somebody's life, they're not all of a person, you know, and we're talking about rounded individuals here, and it's a bit sad to reduce people to just their diagnosis.
Yes.
So, yeah, I just wanted to make that point.
No, it's a good point.
So, we're at a point where we've found Elaine's remains. We've found personal evidence, so her keys, her loyalty card, two mobile phones, and we've also discovered all this BDSM kit. And it seems like the BDSM was quite a big part of the story for people.
Yeah, in Catholic Ireland, it is scandalous. It's unusual, and it makes for very lurid headlines in the tabloid papers. What do you know about BDSM?
Well, I do know that a healthy BDSM relationship does not involve murder.
Yes, I think that's a healthy anything.
does not involve murder. Yeah, well,
or death
yeah.
in at any, you know.
Yeah.
You know, unless it's very tragic, I mean, all precautions should be taken.
I would say so. It is possible for people to have BDSM relationships which are safe and respectful. And for some people, they can actually be something that bonds them much closer with their partner because they develop a very deep trust with each other. So I think the way it sometimes gets reported as this kind of quite lurid thing doesn't, again, we're not reflecting necessarily what's the day-to-day experience of people actually is in kind of like just pulling everybody down into, oh, you've got a mental health problem. Oh, you're into kink. Oh, you're into that.
It was inevitable.
Yeah, it was inevitable. And we've seen a lot of this recently. There's been a campaign group called We Can't Consent to This. And it was founded because so many people were using what's called the rough sex defense when somebody has murdered, normally women. There's been a few cases of men, but it's normally been women. And that is when somebody's found dead, their partner, ex-partner, one night stand, whoever is found to have committed it, they go to trial and they're like, well, they're like rough sex. But there's quite a difference between liking rough sex and asking to be murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why We Can't Consent to This was founded. And since 1972, that defence has been used in 60 murders in the UK. I think it's 60 murders of women, 7 of men, and 115 non-fatal assaults.
Right.
It just seems to me it's a really, really horrible, really victim-blamey way.
Yeah.
Of perpetrators trying to get out of the repercussions and the consequences of the violence mm-hmm. they have caused.
Yes. No, I think it should be easy to establish a threshold which is accepted within the relationship and something that goes beyond that to something that is life-threatening. I don't think that's a very grey area or a difficult area to identify. I think that should be pretty clear-cut. In most people's minds.
I think for most people it is, but I think some people might have a lot of difficulty with that. I don't know how many
or
people...
Maybe it should be expected that we have
yes.
that.
I don't know in these cases how many times this is somebody who has ended up taking someone's life, panicked, and then it's been suggested, oh, you can use this as your defense. And they're like, well, that's the only thing I have to cling on to stop myself going to jail.
Yeah.
And how many times it's people who have just had no care whatsoever for their partner at all.
Yeah, but I think that's an interesting distinction. But I think the having no care, I mean, the act of murdering someone, I don't really feel, especially when it's in the something as I don't know, as intimate and as tactile as the sexual domain, I think the act of murder is pretty, you have to be murderous. I don't think you can just happen, you know, willy-nilly.
Well, there is also manslaughter and death by misadventure.
Yeah.
And so murder is a category and it's a way we categorise.
Okay.
But there can be different ways people meet their death when other people are involved.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe murders is a bit too simplistic, but there are different categories. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, I mean, so you think there's a possibility for unintentionality?
I don't think in necessarily every case people are setting out in a premeditated way to do it, but that doesn't mean they don't have responsibility for what happens. You know, adults who are at full capacity and are intelligent people should be able to find a line. And I don't know how many cases drink and drugs have been involved in, but if somebody knows that when they drink or take drugs, they become violent, that's still their choice to drink and take drugs. And then the consequences are somebody else's.
And if you kill somebody whilst driving under the influence of drink or drugs, it's not an excuse to mitigate the your actions. It's actually it's a further... kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, a worse condition under which is to judge and pass sentence upon you.
Yeah, so it used to be a mitigating circumstance. Like within my lifetime, it was considered a mitigating circumstance, but that has changed now, and it's no longer considered one. But I think culturally you might still have pockets of people who would still sort of see that as a, oh, well, he was drunk, he didn't know what he was doing. And it's like, but when you drink to excess, you make choice.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know, then you bring in sort of degrees of addiction and other things, and it starts getting a bit hazy for me sometimes.
But I think the law as it currently stands is fairly reasonable in terms of like... as a good deterrent for people to not go near a vehicle if under the influence.
I think so, and I would strongly suggest that people don't kill other people.
It's true. I mean, we are, the case we're talking about now actually doesn't involve substances at all.
It doesn't, so I don't know why we've gone down this massive tangent.
It was interesting, but it's also interesting to look at the cold-hearted, calculated nature of the murder. I mean, first of all, the mobile phones were purchased a full year and a half, 18 months before the murder. So that in itself is a clear indication of planning. And then when you put together the previous accusations against the murderer and his fetishization of knives within the sexual arena, you have a lot of red flags again for kind of maybe the inevitability is too strong a word, but definitely the signals were there.
Yeah, I would say so. So just before we go further on, I do have a question for you. I've heard some people say Garda and some people say Gardaí. Which one is it?
Well, it's both, really. Garda is the individual, the policeman, or PC, because you can say Garda James O'Donoghue. But the collective term is the Gardaí, which is short for An Garda Síochána, which means guardians of the peace.
Which I love, actually. It's nice and poetic.
It is. And they are, I mean, this is a police force formed at the inception of the state after independence from Britain. So I suppose it was an intentional move away from the more brutal policing efforts of the British in Ireland at the time, especially during the War of Independence. And as a consequence, the Irish police have traditionally been an unarmed police force, which is kind of unusual, I think, in today's world. I mean, obviously, there are armed units within the police force. But generally speaking, your average Garda on the Shroid or street would be unarmed.
You were really pleased to say Shroid, weren't you?
I was, yeah.
I could hear that. So we've talked a bit about Elaine. We've talked a little bit about how it was discovered that she had been murdered. And I think we probably need to talk a little bit about the person who murdered her, Graham O'Dwyer. Now, there's...
Graham Dwyer.
Is that... That's me being racist against Irish people, just adding an O's willy-nilly.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. I apologise to the nation of Ireland. So, Graham Dwyer. And I think that there's a lot of tropes around this murder. So people are kind of like, oh, it was almost a perfect murder. But I don't actually think it was. And there's also a kind of aggrandizement of Dwyer as well when they're kind of saying these things. Because it's like, he went under the radar for so long. Nobody knew. He seemed like a very middle class, mild-mannered family man. And this kind of, it almost sets him up to be kind of like a master of disguise who could almost do the perfect murder. And I just don't think he deserves that kind of aggrandizement. I think if you actually look at Dwyer and the murder, it wasn't as great as it seems.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's a lot of problems with the way he went about what he did, and a lot of mistakes were made, and I don't think I'm not sure. It's not, for me, it's not that it's a perfect murder or that he's this criminal mastermind. It's that he is this person within society who is in the elite. And I suppose it's the nature of Irish culture that elevates people who reach certain social strata. And there's a sense that they've done so well, so how could they possibly be bad people? And so he's an architect, he's a very wealthy individual from a wealthy family, married into wealth as well, lives in a very, very posh area of Dublin. So he has all the trappings of this elite. And so it's very jarring when someone from this part of society is accused of doing something like this. And I think also the nature of the planning that went into it is, you know, we've shown that it was flawed, and obviously some of it was partially, you know, decisions that were made, but also environmental situations and global warming, etc. And also the kind of doggedness of people and the police to kind of pursue this. They could have left it, but they decided to pursue it. So it's kind of circumstantial, almost accidental discovery kind of makes it remarkable. And it's almost filmic in the way that the body and the evidence is discovered within days of each other. Mm. And the speed within, he's arrested like within 6 weeks, I think.
Yeah, it's actually quite quick.
It's incredibly quick. The speed at which it unravels is quite notable, and coupled with obviously the thought and planning that went into it, years of planning, and like quite a lot of, you know, decisions were made, and you know, the phone buying and the, you know, trying to keep this that level of distance between himself and his actions by having separate phones for both of them that he would then dispose of. And I mean, obviously, as soon as they were found, they leave such a thick marker because of phone mast detection, location detection. That was really his undoing.
Yeah, so the Sunday World podcast really focuses on how they worked out the phone triangulation. Mm-hmm. Different podcasts on this focus on different aspects, and they seem to go quite hard on that triangulation. And I think it was like a woman with some sort of advanced mathematics degree who worked it out. And I think that in a way shows how much crime detection has changed with technology.
Yeah.
I feel like if this murder had taken place in, say, the 90s,
mm-hmm.
they might not have been able to find him. But because it took place where we have that ability to triangulate mobile phone signals,
mm-hmm.
he was found. So I think it is very specifically about a time and a place.
Yeah.
His capture.
Yeah, I think it wasn't like Serial, the first series of Serial involved very, very early case of triangulation of phone data.
Yeah, there was a lot of pinging off masts.
But I think it was quite flawed. And obviously in Ireland, you've got a much smaller population than you would have in any kind of urban area in a larger country in the UK or in the United States. So it just brings down the amount of data that you're sifting through.
Mm.
But at the same time, it's really impressive how they were able to identify the phone heading down this road and coupling that with kind of the toll. So tolls are automated in Ireland on certain roads. So you don't have a barrier to go through. They basically just clock your registration number and then will charge you to your account that you've already set up, or will charge you, you know, to your address if you haven't set one up.
You have tolls on roads?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, we have tolls on roads. Do you not? Yeah, it's quite a normal thing in most other countries. I didn't think that you didn't have them in the UK.
We used to have tolls on certain bridges.
Yeah, we have tolls on bridges as well.
But we don't have those anymore.
Okay. No, it's part of a kind of a public-private initiative for these infrastructure projects. So they get people to take on the building of these roads or bridges, and then they get to basically take the revenue from the tolls for 10, 15, 20 years, whatever.
There used to be a toll on the Sky Bridge and it was very controversial.
Yeah, I think they were controversial in Ireland for a while, and then the government just persisted in using them, and now everyone just accepts them.
Okay.
But, I mean, the flip side is that you now have this data where they were able to identify the cars traveling down this road at this time, and they were able to look for cars that were owned by people who lived in Dublin, someone who lived in the south of Dublin, someone who worked in the centre of Dublin, and they were basically able to narrow it down, or this woman was able to narrow it down really quickly to one person, and that was the murderer.
There was also something about he was part of a model aeroplane group, and he'd just come fifth place in a competition. And I think he mentioned this
in the text.
Because that
brag about his
sexy chat,
placing fifth in the model aeroplane competition.
Oof, what a man!
Yeah,
because
again, indications of a small world where there's only one model airplane competition in Dublin at that time, in that period of time. So again, that was a very easy find.
Yeah. Yeah. So I kind of feel like, rather than aggrandizing Dwyer as this person who pulled off the almost perfect murder, the people here who should be aggrandized are the mathematicians who sifted through a huge amount of data. I know Ireland has a smaller population, but it's still a lot of data to sift through.
And it's not just the sifting through the data, it's the decision to look for that, I think, is really impressive. Like, to know what to look for. Mm. Yeah.
But also, like, the Garda who finds the loyalty cards and instead of just going, oh, lost property, actually decided to go further and phone up the store and try to find who they belong to. And, you know, there's a series of events.
Even he got this bag, and I think there was some BDSM gear as with the bag that this fisherman had found. And so his decision to go back there to further investigate, when it was something like, I mean, how many times do bags get handed in to police stations?
Oh, it must be all the time.
Yeah. So it's that decision to kind of follow up on that, to be assiduous and to do your job properly, is quite impressive.
Yeah, so I think rather than Dwyer having the almost perfect murder, I think Dwyer had a sloppiness that good policing and good forensic work
and
was able to expose.
And kind of also an aware public who are public-minded enough to hand things in. Yeah, and even the discovery of the body to kind of flag that up as well, although that's probably something you're going to do.
I think most people would.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I suppose it was like there was a piece of clothing brought along, but you could, you know, dismiss that as just, oh, it's a bit of a rag or something. You know? It's a year old thing, so it's going to look, you know, like just rubbish. The fact that people are taking these issues seriously and reporting them is, you know, is definitely the factor, a key factor in the whole case.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's what we should focus on with it. And one of the other tropes around this is he was an ordinary family man trope. And that sort of feeds into what you were saying about, you know, he was a successful architect, his wife was an architect, they had what looked like a really lovely middle-class life, middle-class family, and sort of fairly...
They had appeared in the newspaper in 2007 after renovating a house in Dublin, and they like got a feature on the front cover of the property section of the Irish Times. That's a kind of an indicator of how much he had arrived, as it were, into the elite.
Have you ever been on the front cover of the property section of the Irish Times?
I have not.
And do you feel ashamed?
No. But that's not what I aspire to.
What section of the Irish Times do you aspire to?
None.
Oh. Not even obituaries?
No.
Okay. So anyway, there is this sort of idea that he was an ordinary family man and nobody knew what was going on underneath. Mm. Because he very definitely has some kind of personality disorder going on. It's not for me to really sort of diagnose, but possibly some kind of psychopath sociopath, something like that.
Well, the psychiatrists that they had on the podcast seems to... I mean, was he not assessed? I'm certain, and it doesn't... I don't know that I... think about it, I don't think there was an official... You'd think there would be an assessment of his mental health.
I think...
Or did that not really matter?
I don't know the ins and outs of the Irish court system, but I think people very often do have to have their mental health assessed, even if they are like put into prison. Mm. There should be a mental health assessment done to see if people are a risk for sort of suicide or self-harm or things like that. That's a bit different from doing an assessment which ends up with a sort of a diagnosis of something like a personality disorder, which is a lifelong condition.
Yeah.
And probably takes quite a bit of time to work out as well, and expertise to work that out.
Okay.
And I don't really know enough about the Irish criminal system to know at what point that would come into play.
Mm.
But you would imagine any defence would probably look at his mental health as a mitigating circumstance.
But would psychopathy be a mitigating factor?
No, it's not a mitigating factor, but...
I'm sorry, Your Honour, but I'm a psychopath. It doesn't really sound that good.
I'm incurable. So just let me free. No, but I think mental health often is brought into cases because... You know, people can snap under certain conditions. There can be certain things that push people over the edge. You know, I think a classic one would be a woman who's murdered her husband and it feels to everyone like she's murdered him in cold blood, but then it comes out that she's been battered for years and years and then finally snapped psychologically. That is considered a mitigating circumstance and possibly a reason why somebody might get a shorter sentence. Being a psychopath, I think, is actually possibly a reason to get a longer sentence.
Yeah.
So it's the other end of the scale. But at some point, I'm sure he would have had some sort of mental health assessment. But to get back to, again, the aggrandizing of Dwyer, the way they kind of do, oh, he was an ordinary family man and he fooled us all. I don't think he was an ordinary family man who fooled us all. I think he just wasn't someone we looked at closely, because when you get further into the case, he had actually terrorized a previous girlfriend for years. Not just like a short time around a breakup, he had difficulty dealing with his emotions. He had terrorized her. And she actually came into court and talked about it. And I think the only reason you can say, oh, he's an ordinary family man, when there's actually almost a decade's worth of evidence.
How had he terrorized her?
I can't remember, because it was a while ago I listened to the podcast.
It is. He was, first of all, during their relationship that they had while he was in university in Dublin studying architecture, as she was too, he would bring a knife to the bed when they were having sex, and it kind of escalated. There was never any physical damage done, but it was definitely a prop, let's say, for him. So that's, you know, not a good sign, I would say.
No, it's not.
And then she went on to get pregnant, and she had a son. So they had a son together, and they broke up shortly afterwards. But he continued to harass her.
Mm.
And it's unclear to what the nature of that was, or I didn't notice the details, but just clearly somebody who bears grudges and has this kind of violent inclination.
And this love control.
And need to control, and love of knives as well. And there were also other elements of his love of violence that he did that were found in his burgeoning literary career?
Oh, yes, there was the writing, which, yeah, so he wrote some short stories where he was giving free rein to his fantasies, and they weren't great. They weren't great stories to begin with,
no.
But they also weren't great. Although I have to admit, one did make me laugh, because there's a sentence that was read out on the Sunday News podcast where he said something like, "And then I can be just like my hero, God."
Yes, in taking a life, I can be just like my hero, God.
And I was like, what an absolute twat.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So, yes, he had a history. He had a history of controlling behavior. He doesn't sound like he was probably a great guy, but from the outside, if you weren't close to him, he probably seemed quite run of the mill and quite ordinary. So I kind of feel like the idea that he was an ordinary family man is an idea that comes from a culture of not looking much deeper into people.
Mm.
You know, it's like everything's fine on the surface, so everything's fine.
Yeah.
Whereas if they led with Graham O'Dwyer, whose reign of terror on his ex-girlfriend has now been found to have murdered another partner, that makes him sound a lot worse. But it also makes it sound a lot obvious. And I think people around Dwyer probably wouldn't like the fact that he fooled them so much. So it's easier to say, oh, he fooled us all. He had us all absolutely under his spell, than just to say, no, there's actually violent, controlling men in all walks of life, and you cannot tell who they are just by looking at them.
Yeah. And I think also at the time in Ireland, it was at the, you know, the, so first of all, up to the 2008, there was the Celtic Tiger. So this was where the wealth of the country rose exponentially and became a very, you know, Ireland became very rich, and people became very obsessed with money. And actually then after the crash, there was a big downturn, and a lot of people suffered, people who had previously been doing well. And actually, Graham Dwyer was one of these people. He suffered huge cuts to his income. His wife lost her job. And so for a man who is so obsessed with status, this obviously was a huge challenge to him. And he became very frustrated. And clearly he wanted to take out this frustration in various violent ways.
Yeah, I think that it does seem like the financial pressure had an impact on him. But I also feel like he was controlled as well. Like, he bought those phones the year before.
Oh,
yes. He had planned it all.
Yes.
So I'm not sure we can do a he was an ordinary man who snapped either.
No. I suppose what I just mean is that that's the kind of pushed him, his frustrations pushed him in that way. But I suppose I also mean that the way in which society doesn't question, or there's no room for questioning people's behavior, is kind of explained by this obsession with financial status.
As long as people are doing okay financially, we assume they're okay.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Mm.
On the Sunday World podcast again, which I think if any listeners want to listen further, I would recommend the Sunday World podcast as one of the best out there on it, although I have a few caveats I'll get to in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought one of the really interesting things the psychologist on the Sunday World podcast said was that one of the reasons Dwyer wasn't sort of identified as a psychopath by those around him was mainly because it got expressed in middle class ways. We kind of expect psychopaths to be the kind of people who walk down a street on a Friday night drunk and just want to start a fight. Whereas if you're middle class and you're a psychopath, you have ways to let that aggression out, which seem more acceptable, like, say, playing rugby and being on the rugby pitch. I find that inclusion in the Sunday World podcast very useful to kind of think about in terms of who Dwyer was. But I actually found that podcast the best out of all the ones we listened to on this case.
What did you think of the dramatization of their text messages?
Yeah, so this would be a caveat that I put out there as a warning to people. They start off with actors reading some of the text messages between Elaine and Graham, and it hits hard.
Yeah, it's really effective. I think they really good acting. I think they really get the characters across, and because you have a voiced, it just kind of brings the relationship and the toxic relationship fleshes it out amazingly.
Yeah, it really does.
But it is shocking.
You get a real sense of the character of Elaine and her vulnerability as well.
And it's serious trigger warning territory.
It really is. I would say that in any group of people, because I listen and read and watch a lot of true crime, I'm normally the one who is the least squeamish and can deal with the most awful stuff. I found that hard to deal with. And I think, again, it's a testament to how good a podcast it actually was and how well produced it was. It's a journalist called Nicola Tallant. I had no idea of the Sunday World before you told me about it. And because it was a tabloid, I was thinking, oh, I don't know what this is going to be like, because they're not known historically to be the most sensitive around things such as mental health problems or kink or anything like that.
Mm.
But I actually found it hugely respectful and really well done.
Yeah, I think it was. I was expecting also, because I knew that it was the Sunday World that were producing it, I'd gone into it assuming that it would be sensationalist.
Another weird ad, though, I have to say.
Yeah.
Its ad starts off, "Do you want to start conversations like a pro?"
Like a professional conversationalist.
A professional, like, I mean,
how much can you get paid to be a professional conversationalist?
I think Graham Norton gets quite a lot.
But I don't think he uses the Sunday World.
Well, I don't know. We'd have to ask him. But, you know, I don't think there's a lot of slots for professional conversationalists.
No, I don't think it exists as a category.
No.
But even if it did exist as a category, you shouldn't apply if you're a what?
Oh, I love this little bit. It's like, you shouldn't apply if you're a crooked politician or part of a drug cartel.
Or a reality TV
person who cares about other people's opinions. All said really quickly, like the terms and conditions at the end of
a banking commercial.
Yeah. So I did quite enjoy that slightly tongue-in-cheek.
Yes, I think it was effective.
Yeah, it was good. So that's
the story.
Poor Elaine O'Hara. Mm-hmm. At least she and her family got some justice in the end. And well done, the Garda, the Gardaí, the sciencey people.
Although there is a stage of appeal where Graham Dwyer is hoping to use EU legislation, which is very very tight on the use of mobile phone data, to throw the case out and to overturn his conviction. But it would be unbelievably unlikely that would happen. Even if it did at this stage, you know, if they had to throw out the mobile phone data, they have enough information and they have enough evidence from everything else. But it's just an interesting observation.
If he did get out, I couldn't imagine he'd be safe for very long. Plus, you can also just leave the EU. It's super easy. It causes no problems.
Well, that's true.
And everyone's really happy afterwards.
Yeah, that would be one option. Irexit.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Bye.
thank you for listening. Goodbye.
You have been listening to True Crime Fiction, the podcast that is feeding your addiction to all things crime. You can find our website at true-crime-fiction.com, on Twitter at true_crime_fic, on Facebook and Instagram as True Crime Fiction. Please rate and review on the podcast app of your choice. Music is by Kitty Kitty Meow Meow.
What a depressing note to end on.